Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and if you've been paying attention to most political coverage recently, you could be forgiven for not knowing that we're just 2.5 months away from Election Day. And of course, I'm not talking about anything related to the primaries or the presidential election at all, for that matter. I'm talking about the first Tuesday of this November, when voters in a handful of states will head to the polls to elect state legislators and or governors. Those states are Virginia, New Jersey, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Kentucky. And a number of those elections are competitive and could be decisive in determining whether or not one party has full control of state government. And taking a look at those elections will also help give us a sense of the current national environment and how it's evolved since the very blue days of 2018. So here with me to do that are two 538 elections analysts. They are Nathaniel Rakich, who's joining us from Boston. Hello, Nathaniel.
Hey, Galen.
And also with us is Jeffrey Skelly, joining us from Charlottesville. How's it going?
Hey, doing well.
So, Nathaniel, just to kick us off here, can you give us a quick rundown of the state-level races on the ballot this fall?
Sure thing. So there are three gubernatorial races in pretty red states. Those are Kentucky, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Interestingly, given how red those states are, all three are competitive. Democrats might end up winning all three. They currently have just one of them, and I'm sure we'll get into that. In addition, there are state legislative elections in both New Jersey and Virginia, but Virginia is really just what we're interested in because Democrats also have a good shot at flipping both the state Senate and the state House there, which would give them full control of government. And then, of course, there are always special elections, most notably in the North Carolina 9th District, which is the district where the result was overturned in 2018 because of absentee ballot election fraud.
And that special election in North Carolina is actually in just a few weeks. We don't have to wait until November to get the results there. Jeffrey, what do you see as the most significant races this year in 2019 because either they're competitive or could change the balance of power in the states where they're taking place?
Well, I mean, I'm a homer. I'm from Virginia. So obviously the Virginia state legislative elections are interesting to me for the redistricting ramifications or potential ramifications after the 2020 census. Right now there's divided government in Virginia. But the fact that Democrats do have a shot at taking control of the General Assembly, the state legislature, could actually give them full control. And so potentially they could be in a position to control the redistricting process. Besides that, obviously the statewide elections, you have a fairly moderate, even conservative Democrat in John Bel Edwards in Louisiana trying to hold on. That's interesting. For sure. And then the Kentucky race, because Matt Bevin is arguably the most unpopular governor in the country, but he's a Republican in a red state in Kentucky. And the son of a former governor, Andy Beshear, is the Democrat challenging him. So those are the races I'm sort of most interested in.
I want to dig into all of that. But first off, because you started with Virginia, the last time we talked about Virginia state politics on this podcast was in February, and that's because of a triple scandal facing the Democrats there. As a refresher, in case anybody forgot, the governor, Ralph Northam, was in a college photo wearing either blackface or a KKK outfit. The lieutenant governor, Justin Fairfax, was accused of rape, and the attorney general also said that he wore blackface decades ago. That, of course, also happens to be the line of succession for the governorship. Anyway, they're all still in office. Jeff, how is that affecting the race there? Has that made Democrats' job harder of trying to win the state legislature?
I think it's debatable if it's had much of an effect. I think the national conditions at the end of the day are the most important thing, and President Trump remains relatively unpopular in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and that is maybe the saving grace for Democrats. That's given them a shot at taking control of the state legislature, because if the governor's standing were playing a bigger role, I think they'd be in a worse position. And so the fact that Governor Northam in the most recent morning consult data on approval rating still had a slightly net positive gubernatorial rating in terms of his approval, it's probably a good sign for Democrats, all things considered, because obviously the nature of the scandal was one where the numbers you saw right after the scandal were very negative, of course, but it doesn't seem like that's necessarily carried over or continued on from sort of the period earlier this year.
Yeah, I'll just add to that that there is lots of political science research that also indicates that even state legislative races are increasingly tied to presidential partisanship these days. We know this about the Senate and the House, of course, but the one study found that presidential approval rating has at least three times the impact on state legislative races that opinions of the state legislature do. So I definitely agree with Jeffrey that opinions of Trump are going to be more on voters' minds than these scandals.
How close are Democrats to actually taking control of the state house in Virginia? Because I remember in the immediate aftermath of Donald Trump winning the presidential election, they had state legislative elections in 2017 that we all paid a lot of attention to, and Democrats still didn't win a majority then. So is there any reason to believe that they would win a majority now, that some of the energy has worn off of the hashtag resistance in response to Trump?
Yeah, so basically what's going on in Virginia is that you have both houses of the state legislature with very narrow Republican control. There have been a couple resignations, but really for the purposes of just the arithmetic, it's easiest to say that Republicans have a 51-49 edge in the House of Delegates, and Republicans have a 21-19 edge in the state Senate. With the lieutenant governor being the tiebreaker in the state Senate, that means Democrats only need a net gain of one seat to take the state Senate. And that seems pretty likely based on sort of the makeup of the races that are competitive. Republicans are defending a handful of seats that are in districts that Clinton carried in 2016 pretty handily. So it's going to be, I think, difficult for the GOP to hold on to the state Senate. Meanwhile, in the House of Delegates, Democrats gained a bunch of seats in 2017, partly on the coattails of Ralph Northam's win at the top of the ticket. But they were also basically picking up a lot of seats that had moved to the left at the national level and that Clinton had won, but still had Republican legislators. So now they're trying to hold on to a lot of those seats. But Democrats got a little assist because about a quarter of the seats in the House of Delegates, that are 100 seats, have been redrawn because of a racial gerrymandering case. And that has shifted the map from being one where Hillary Clinton carried 51 of the 100 seats to one where Clinton carried 56 of the 100 seats. And so at the margins, I think you have to say Democrats are slight favorites to take back the House. But I do think it's important for people to understand that this is a very low turnout election. I was checking just before we got on here, and in the past three, you would call them midterm, like state midterm elections in Virginia, so 2015, 2011, 2007, basically 25% of the voting eligible population has shown up. And obviously that is a far cry from what you see in a presidential cycle, for instance, when it's 70%+, or even in a midterm cycle when it's, you know, closer to 50. So very low turnout in this kind of election. So it's, that can make things a little unpredictable, and I think makes it difficult to say, you know, one way or the other, that Democrats are like surefire bet to take back the General Assembly.
Yeah, Nathaniel, what does the electorate look like in an off-off year? So, you know, in a year like 2019, who should we expect to show up to the polls?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically whoever is motivated to vote, because there isn't going to be that top of the ticket pressure. Another thing I wanted to add to Jeffrey's take in answer to your question, Galen, is that it's also important to note that the Virginia State Senate wasn't actually on the ballot in 2017. Virginia State Senators only go every 4 years. So I think if it had been on the ballot, there was a good chance Democrats would have taken that chamber. So this is the first time that chamber is going to be exposed in the Trump era. So that plus the redistricted state House map, I think, gives Democrats a pretty good shot at taking both chambers.
And of course, as Jeffrey mentioned, states are going to be redrawing their district lines in 2020, and that will be affecting elections for the next decade. So if they were to take the state House and Senate, that has significant implications, at least in that state going forward. Nathaniel, you mentioned at the top that there are three competitive gubernatorial elections in red states. Why are we seeing competitive elections in Louisiana, Kentucky, and Mississippi? Like, wouldn't you just expect a Republican to take all three of those governorships?
Yeah, you would. And there's a good chance that that still might happen. You know, partisanship may just prove to be too powerful of a force. But the reason that you're seeing those three be competitive, I think, is different in each state. So in Louisiana, first of all, you have the fact that you have an incumbent Democratic governor, John Bel Edwards. He won in 2015, mostly, I think, because he ran against David Vitter, who was surrounded by scandals, including his prostitution scandal when he was a U.S. senator. And Edwards has been popular so far. He's gotten generally good reviews for his governance. He recently signed a big bill to kind of stabilize Louisiana's state finances. So there's a pretty good shot that he gets reelected.
And he's pretty conservative, right? Didn't he sign an abortion restriction bill recently?
Exactly. That's, I think, what he's most known for nationally, is that he signed this bill that banned abortions after a certain period of time. I forget exactly how many weeks, but he is pro-life, and I think that's a big part of his appeal. He has that, you know, to borrow the phrase that Claire uses a lot on the podcast, he has the political pheromones of Louisiana conservatives and Republicans. In the other states, in Mississippi, you have a very strong Democratic candidate in the Attorney General, Jim Hood. He's the only currently statewide elected Democrat. He's been elected a few times as Attorney General, and people there seem to like him. He's always won by pretty comfortable margins. Now, of course, trying to advance to a promotion against another pretty formidable Republican candidate, probably Lieutenant Governor Tate Reeves, although he still has to face a runoff in the Republican primary. That's going to be a close race that will probably boil down to, well, it could boil down to partisanship, but basically Hood's chances ride on whether he is able to distinguish himself from the National Democratic brand and how well-liked he is. And then finally, in Kentucky, as Jeffrey mentioned, Governor Bevin is just very unliked. He's running against somebody with a good last name in Andy Beshear.
Why is he so unliked?
He is a bit of a controversial figure. Our colleague Perry Bacon Jr. wrote a piece about how he was a bit of a proto-Trump. So he has made several kind of questionable comments. He presided over a big cut to pensions in the state that spurred teachers to protest en masse. And he made comments about how, because the teachers were at the state capitol and not taking care of their kids, that he guaranteed, quote unquote, that somewhere in Kentucky a child had been abused that day. And you know, it was really a series in a line of kind of bizarre comments from him. So he's just, he you know, raises a lot of trouble. He doesn't really care about having a bombastic image. And yet, because of partisanship, he may still win out. But it's also worth noting that Kentucky is a bit of an ancestrally Democratic state. That's kind of true for all three of these states because they're all southern states. But Kentucky is a state that really, until very recently, had no problem electing Democratic governors as well as statewide officials. So Andy Beshear himself, the Democratic candidate, is the Attorney General of Kentucky. There is another Democratic statewide elected official, I think, before 2015. All of them were, or most of them were, Democrats as well.
All right. Before we get into more general indicators like the generic ballot, are there any other, I know New Jersey's also out there, are there any other races that we should keep an eye on this fall?
Well, the special elections in North Carolina are going to draw interest coming up in September. One is not competitive. It's in a very Republican-leaning seat, the North Carolina 3rd, where the now-deceased Walter Jones Jr. Was the longtime Republican representative there. He passed away, and so they're having a special. But then you have in the Republican 9th district the sort of do-over election after basically the votes were thrown out, and I feel like I'm taking over Nathaniel's territory a little bit. He's written extensively about this, but you can expect a very competitive election there. Anyway, I'm going to let Nathaniel take over that one. He's written so much about it. I feel like I'm all over his turf.
No worries. Yeah, so the North Carolina 9th is the redo of this election between Republican Mark Harris and Democrat Dan McCready. As you might recall, an operative for the Harris campaign actually ended up recently being indicted for his role in this election fraud scandal where his campaign workers would go around collecting absentee ballots from people and mailing them in for them, which in North Carolina is against the law. There were also allegations that they would fill in these ballots and that they would collect them unsealed and vote for the Republican candidate.
Hold on. And just to clarify here, who is Harris? He was not the incumbent. Who was he?
He was a reverend, a locally known reverend around North Carolina, who defeated the incumbent, Rep. Robert Pittenger, in the primary, which in that primary, in fact, was also very close and was also allegedly influenced by these fraudulently cast absentee ballots.
And this has been a traditionally Republican seat. So is it just this scandal that's making it competitive?
No, in fact, it's unclear whether the scandal is having much of an impact at all. You're absolutely right. This is a traditionally Republican seat. It is R plus 14 by our partisan lean metric, which means it's 14 points more Republican leaning than the nation as a whole. So normally this would be a pretty safe seat. But in 2018, in the election that was eventually annulled, it was within less than 1,000 votes. So it was extremely close. I think you can credit Dan McCready, the Democratic candidate, who is a Marine veteran, very kind of appealing guy. You can credit him for running a strong campaign. So I think there is every reason to believe it will be competitive again, perhaps not that close because the national environment maybe isn't as blue as it was in 2018, but it's certainly competitive. Both parties, the National Republican Party and the National Democratic Party, are pouring a lot of money into this race. McCready has raised a ton of money based on the scandal, which has really boosted his national profile. But actually, based on reports on the ground, it doesn't sound like the scandal is coming up all that often. It sounds like it's coming up in Bladen and Robeson counties, the two places where the fraudulent absentee ballot harvesting was supposedly taking place. But outside that, it's really based on the issues, and the candidates are also attacking each other on their record. So McCready is running again for Democrats, and then the new Republican nominee, after Harris understandably declined to run in the redo election, is State Senator Dan Bishop, who has a controversial record in the state Senate. For example, he was one of the main sponsors of the bathroom bill that told people in North Carolina that they had to use the bathroom of their birth gender.
So we'll definitely be keeping an eye on that special election as we get closer to the date, which is in mid-September. But you mentioned there that part of the reason this might be less competitive is because the national environment has changed. So let's dig into that. I know that in 2018, we talked a lot about the generic ballot and what it portended for those midterm elections. Where is the generic ballot today in comparison to 2018?
Oh, well, the generic ballot is around D plus six, about a 6-point Democratic advantage. So comparatively speaking, going into the midterm, I believe it was about D plus 8 or D plus 9, sort of depending on the day. So slightly less favorable for Democrats than it was, but still perhaps more favorable than you might see in a really neutral environment.
And that generic ballot that was D plus 8 or 9 going into the midterms, that ended up being more or less accurate, right?
Yeah, I mean, more or less. I mean, look, one of the complications with calculating out the popular vote in the House is that there are a number of districts where one party isn't running. But more or less, that was about what the national popular vote worked out to be in the U.S. House of Representatives elections.
Yeah, I think Democrats won the national popular vote by 8.6 points was the final number, not accounting for those uncontested races.
And just to clarify also for listeners, since we haven't talked about this for a while, the generic ballot is when pollsters just ask voters, would you vote for a Republican or a Democrat for Congress? And there's not a name attached. So you kind of strip away any of the local issues or whatever and just ask people Democrat or Republican. Right now, it's D plus six. So it has moved to the right a little bit from where we were in 2018. How big of a change is that 2 points in terms of what we should expect from these fall elections?
Yeah, it's not that big a shift, obviously. I think, you know, there were some situations where you might expect Democrats used up all of their resistance energy and things went back to more of a neutral environment. That certainly is kind of what happened after, for example, the 2010 election, although, of course, President Obama made adjustments after the drubbing of the 2010 election that it doesn't look like President Trump is going to be doing. But it's still a good environment for Democrats. It's interesting because D plus six is kind of right, maybe teetering on the edge where if that stays for 2020, it would be right about where at the tipping point for Senate control. I think it'd be enough for a Democrat to win the presidency, certainly, but the Senate might be on a knife's edge there. But it's also worth noting, I think, our tracker of generic ballot polling does have this D plus six measure, but we don't have a lot of polls, and particularly not a lot of high quality live interviewer polls. So that's worth noting if, you know, maybe there is a signal that we're missing because some of those higher quality pollsters like a Quinnipiac or a Monmouth haven't asked this question in a while.
Yeah, another indicator that we used in 2018 to talk about what we could expect from the midterm elections was the results of special elections. And even though there haven't been that many special federal elections, so for the House or Senate, of course, there are special elections in state legislatures all across the country kind of all the time. So from looking at special elections in state legislatures, can we tell whether or not that generic ballot polling seems to be on point?
Yeah, it's actually very consistent with that generic ballot polling. I have been tracking state legislative special elections like the nerd that I am. In fact, we just had two this Tuesday. And so far this year, the average overperformance from partisan lean is 6 points by Democrats. And if you recall the 2018 cycle, we often made a big deal about how in races like Connor Lamb's race in Pennsylvania or the Ohio 12th race, there was this kind of a similar Democratic performance. The average swing, including legislative special elections, so not just federal, in 2018 was D plus 10. So it's telling basically the same story as the generic ballot, which is that it's a slightly less blue environment, but it's still pretty blue. And in fact, both the special elections and the generic ballot are saying the same thing, which is D plus 6. I think I don't want to maybe overfit that and say, oh, that's precisely what it is right now, because those are both imperfect measures. But it is notable that they are in agreement right now.
Is there any reason, Jeff, to expect that as we get into a presidential cycle, and I know there are so many unpredictable things that could happen, so maybe this question is moot, but like, if you can, as we head into a presidential election cycle and more people start paying attention to national politics, do we expect some of that Democratic advantage that still remains to revert to the mean at all? What should we expect from generic ballot polling as we get into 2020?
I think some of that is sort of up to what happens in terms of the political conditions. You know, what is President Trump up to? How's his approval rating? Because those are pretty decently correlated, the generic ballot and the president's approval. So if President Trump is still in the low 40s in approval, you know, that might create the conditions for Democrats to continue having at least something of an edge in the generic ballot, which could produce a very favorable electoral result for them come 2020. At the same time, I think it is worth noting that historically, there is some evidence that the generic ballot has a little bit of a Democratic lean to it. At the same time, though, if you do look at where the generic ballot was in some of the most recent electoral cycles, I was somewhat predictive of what came to pass, I guess. So I think it's a cautiously good sign for Democrats that they're at the position they're at right now.
Yeah, I actually wrote an article back in June called Our Best Tool for Predicting Midterm Elections Works in Presidential Years, Too. And in that article, I looked at the early generic ballot polls and how they ended up correlating with the final national popular vote for the House. And I found that it's pretty close, even with early polls, both for presidential cycles and for midterm cycles.
And that is for the House, not for the popular vote in the presidential election.
Correct, although there is some actually a pretty good correlation between those two things as well. And you know, as you know, Galen, as we've all talked about ad infinitum, we live in a very partisan age, and basically people are going to vote the same way up and down the ballot with a few exceptions.
As we wrap up here, we've been talking about state legislative elections, which is not a topic that we get to all that frequently, especially as we gear up for this presidential cycle. But on that topic, the state legislative elections that take place in 2020 are going to be even more important, much more important than the handful of state legislative races that are going to take place this November. In fact, state legislatures across the country will be on the line in 2020, and therefore, who gets to draw the political maps for the next decade will also be on the line. What does the organizing and fundraising and planning look like for the Democrats and the Republicans at this point for those state legislative races?
I think they're preparing pretty seriously. I think both parties are well aware of what happened in 2010, which is that Republicans had a great year and were able to redistrict themselves into a great position for the next 10 years. Democrats, I think, certainly are smarting from that, and they're putting particular effort into it. I actually saw an Associated Press article the other day that said that they're putting a lot of money and effort into organizing on the state legislative level right now. You have new organizations like the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, led by former Attorney General Eric Holder, that is specifically focusing on the races that will decide redistricting. In addition, for the first time, I think in a while, you're seeing some of these Democratic committees like the DLCC, the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, raising as much or maybe even a little bit more as their Republican counterparts, which have historically dominated fundraising.
Although we did mention earlier that increasingly people are just voting the same way up and down the ticket. So even if parties are organizing on the state level for these state legislative races, will it have all that much of an impact in an environment where everyone's focused on Trump versus whoever the Democratic nominee is?
I mean, I think it is important to understand that the presidential race is the biggest driver of turnout. So on the one hand, I think it's a good question and does raise the point that maybe spending a ton of money on this isn't the greatest use of resources. But at the same time, if you don't spend money on those races, one side or the other, you still might have effects at the margins that could make the difference in some state legislative contests. And so if one side is spending a ton of money and the other is not even remotely equaling it, you can at least get some benefit from it if you're the side spending a ton more money. But it is at the margin. So, you know, if Democrats are winning a sweeping victory in the presidential race, or if Donald Trump has recovered and handily defeats whomever the Democrats put up, their party is going to benefit a great deal down ballot. But at the same time, it might be a very close race at the top of the ticket. And, you know, people are scraping for every vote they can get. And if you're spending a lot of money and your opposition is not in a state legislative contest, I mean, there's plenty of evidence that there is some connection there between who spends the most and who wins. So I think it's just a case where either party wants to give the other an inch.
I think that it can't hurt, right? I mean, I suppose it can hurt because they aren't spending that money on somewhere else that it could be more useful. But I think in order to take advantage of conditions that are driven by the top of the ticket, you do have to have some level of organizing. I think in particular, you have to have competent candidates. So if either party doesn't run anybody, they can't take advantage. I think in 2016, you saw several instances where Republican Trump won areas that nobody expected him to win, including in, you know, Wisconsin, for example, and Republicans didn't even have state legislative candidates running. And the same with Democrats in Texas. Nobody expected that there would be this big Democratic surge in the suburbs of Texas, so they didn't have candidates ready to take advantage of that. And I think similarly in 2020, the states that aren't presidential swing states run the risk of not having much infrastructure or money in them, and this effort by both parties will ensure that they do.
All right. Well, plenty to keep our eyes on in 2019 and 2020. But before we go, any other elections, maybe obscure, I don't know, that will be happening this November in 2019 that you have your eyes on?
Well, Galen, I'll be watching every single election down to dog catcher in random rural counties. But I think that's pretty much it for the top line things. There are a handful of cities that are electing new mayors this year. So, for example, Houston and Charlotte could have competitive mayoral elections. You have ballot measures are always fun in off years. You have one in Colorado to legalize sports gambling, for example. But those are still kind of rolling in, and I think it'll be clearer a little closer to the election where the truly competitive and interesting races are for both of those things.
And one thing I will definitely be focusing on is the fact that my birthday falls on election day this year. Always fun to work in this industry and have a birthday the first week of November.
At least it's not election day 2020. You kind of get it out of the way, right, for the next 6-7 years.
Yeah, I was trying to do the math yesterday of, is it going to be 2 days later? Like, it'll be Thursday in 2020, right? Because it's a leap year. Is that how that math works?
Yeah, I think the 2020 election's on November 3rd, if I recall correctly. So however that relates.
Galen, I looked it up, and after 2019, you are in the clear until 2024. So another presidential year.
It's on the presidential in 2024.
November 5th, yep. Fuck. So get ready for that one. Get out of the industry while you still can.
Sounds good. Anyway, thank you so much, Nathaniel and Jeffrey, for joining me today.
Sure thing, Galen.
Hey, thanks for having us.
I've been speaking with 538 Elections analyst Nathaniel Rakich and Jeffrey Skelly. And one last thing before we do go, we got plenty of positive feedback from our exit interview with Eric Swalwell, and we'd like to continue doing exit interviews with candidates as they leave the Democratic primary race. We have reached out to John Hickenlooper He hasn't been in touch at this point. I don't know if he will. I don't know if he's too busy considering whether or not he wants to run for Senate in Colorado. But just so listeners, you have an idea, we would like to continue that series, and we are working away at it. All right. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.